This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
Borders seem to be all over the news lately. You've got trade wars, Brexit, and of course, Trump's wall. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring how borders are created and blurred in the world of food.
We try to focus a lot on the fact that they are chefs by nature, that the refugee thing is just a status for them.
And after the Soviet space ended, I don't think there was much research. It was all considered just Soviet food or Russian food. And I don't think it gives a lot of those cultures credit.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, career changers, creative people, and other assorted nutcases who have made a transition from other industries to work in food. I have two people to introduce you to today. Unfortunately, or fortunately for her, I guess, but unfortunately for us, Jenny is in Morocco eating beautiful things, and you should follow her on Instagram at Chef Jenny Dorsey because everything she's eating looks amazing. But it means she's not here in the studio with me today. So I'm joined actually by a guest co-host, my Burlap and Barrel co-founder, Ori Zohar. Ori, thanks for joining us.
Yay.
And we have an amazing guest this week. I guess we have amazing guests every week, but I'm particularly excited to introduce Min Tsai, who's the founder and CEO of Hodo Foods. Min, thanks for joining us.
Yay.
Yeah, all right. Here all we
go. We're in Brooklyn.
Here in Brooklyn, we've got a little whiskey on the microphone table, and we're ready to go. So, Min, tell us what is Hodo Foods? What do you make, and what's the story?
Great. Well, Hodo Foods, it's a food company that I started 15 years ago. We started out making tofu, but in the last 5 years or so, most of our products are now categorized in the plant-based food space. So you find us everywhere these days, from Target to Whole Foods to Fresh Direct. So we're a national company. We've been around 15 years, and we just make delicious food, Ethan.
Yeah, as I think most food companies try to make some, it's easier for some companies than for others. what's your process for making tofu? What makes your tofu different from what people might have tasted before?
Right. So I started the business because I grew up in Vietnam, and I ate delicious tofu growing up with my grandfather, lots of mom and pop tofu shops in the neighborhoods. But then when I came here, such artisan tofu just didn't exist. So silly me, I decided that I want to make tofu and learn how to make it. And, it happened during the time where farmers markets were proliferating, where organic food was really important for consumers. And it also happened that I grew up in the Bay Area, which is one of the epicenters of foods in the U.S., so these combinations of interest and, receptions from consumers led me to basically tinker and test at the farmers markets and eventually build a plan to make tofu. So I'm happy to walk people through the tofu making process, if it makes sense.
Yeah, let's talk about those early days. You had worked in finance. You'd worked on Wall Street for quite a while before starting the company.
Right.
So tell us about that process. The farmers market launch, what was the first time that you made tofu? How did that idea come about?
Right. So, yeah, definitely huge transitions there. Being a typical immigrant kid with parents that have high expectations, I was a good kid, went to good schools, did all the proper schooling and whatnot, and I ended up working as an investment banker in New York, in fact. And it was great. It was really good because I made a lot of money as an investment banker. I learned a lot about investment banking, which is in itself a very interesting business. But I left because I just didn't know why people had to work so hard with so much money. And so being a curious and an autodidact, I decided that I need to try new things. So I went from investment banking into management consulting. And there too, there was a lot to learn about how to run businesses and how to think strategically. So basically, you know, I'm one of these folks that do something for a few years, you know, try to learn as much as I can, and then got to move on to the next things. And, you know, about 15 years ago, that next thing happened to be a food business. And tofu was one of the ideas that really stuck.
Were there particular lessons that you learned in management consulting or investment banking that you've applied to tofu making? Is there much overlap?
Absolutely. I think there's the business side, and then there's the making side, which is much more culinary based. From a business standpoint, sure, you know, being able to understand finance, being able to understand operations, being able to put together a business plan to raise money, to look at spreadsheets, to do market research, all of that comes from my business and finance background. So I didn't come into it from a culinary background, but much more from a business background. So I learned the culinary piece after I started the business and started tinkering around learning how to make tofu.
So how did you learn how to make tofu?
You know, we have a t-shirt that says, "Who's your tofu master?" And most people are like, "Wow, cool." But it's really ironic because it's kind of like an internal joke that very few people get. And the reason we made that shirt is because there is no such thing as a tofu master. I had to learn tofu making from a small tofu manufacturer in the Bay Area. And I learned it just like you would learn anything like cheese making. You go there and you're like, "Hey, can I volunteer? Can I stage for you?" And in that process, you learn how they make it. There are no systematic scientific way. There was a lot of apprenticeship and observation. And that's exactly what I did. What I managed to do, just because of how my head and my mind works, is I look at these very random way of sort of measuring and whatnot, and I try to systematize it as much as possible. Like, for example, you know, I would ask the tofu maker, "How much coagulant do you put into that milk?" And he would say something like, "Well, you start with a bowl, and if it's not enough, you add more." And, you know, it's not refined or precise at all. So then I would be watching him and saying, "Okay, well, I'm going to measure that. Is it 10 ounce? Is it 12 ounce, et cetera, for a batch of soy milk?" So that's how I learned how to make tofu.
So yeah, walk us through that tofu making process. I mean, people are, I think, pretty familiar with tofu, but I think most people don't know a whole lot about how you get from a soybean to the white block.
Right.
How does that happen?
So tofu has been around for 3,000 years or more. It's sort of an accidental discovery. It's very similar to cheese making. If you think about cheese making, some dude put milk in a bladder and there's some acid in there and it sort of curdle into a cheese. Tofu is very similar. Some dude in Asia was cooking a pot of beans, and you cook beans universally the same way. You soak it overnight and you slow cook it. And somebody decided that it didn't taste savory or good enough, so they added salt and it became a salty bean juice kind of thing, and then they decided to add vinegar, and that's when the curdle happened. So tofu is essentially a high-protein soy milk with a coagulant that basically turned it into a bean curd, very similar to cheese making. The only main difference between cheese making and tofu making is that in cheese making, you have a live culture. You use rennet, whereas in tofu making, you use a coagulant that's a mineral, calcium sulfate. But the process is the same. So first, instead of milking from a cow, you basically take soybeans, high-protein soybeans, you grind it, you cook it, and you separate the pulp from the milk. So that milk has very high protein, very creamy, has a vegetable flavor, a legume flavor, and then you add the coagulant, and it curdles or it becomes a curd, just like cheese.
Is that milk something that people would drink, or is it going to taste comparable to soy milk that people have tasted?
It does, actually. So if you drink soy milk in the supermarket these days, it's likely that they basically have added other flavors, because the assumption is the American public is not familiar with the taste of a beanie juice. But in Asia, it's really prized. You know, people seek a soybean that has flavor of the beans. Whereas here, we're not there yet, but we'll get there eventually. So for us, we don't mask that taste in our tofu. We want you to experience it. We're the first people that tell you that actually tofu has taste and is not just a blank canvas.
I lived above a small storefront tofu factory in Chinatown in Manhattan, probably close to 10 years ago. And the best soy milk I've ever tasted. I would get some basically anytime I walked in or out of my apartment building, I would get a bottle of soy milk. And it had exactly that flavor that you're talking about. It tasted very green. There was this like sort of springtime flavor in the soy
milk. That's how I grew up drinking soy
incredible.
Milk.
Yeah.
Yep.
So how does your tofu taste? How does that flavor express itself in the tofu itself?
Right. So, you know, one of the myths that we try to shatter is the fact that tofu has flavor. And we have to prove that in the making of it, in the tasting of it. So if you actually get our tofu in the supermarket, what you'll find is, the first thing you'll find it has the highest protein among all tofu. The reason it has the highest protein is because we make our tofu with a really thick soy milk. So the metaphor here is, imagine eating a cheese that's made with skimmed milk versus a cheese that's made with high-fat whole milk. So our tofu is the equivalent of a high-fat whole milk cheese versus a skim milk tofu, which is generally what you find in the marketplace, because tofu these days is quite commoditized. There are only two big tofu makers in the entire country, and they basically own more than 80% of the marketplace. And pretty much every tofu you eat, it's made by one of these folks. So we're sort of that artisan company that's really breaking through and changing minds. And for the first time in the last decade, tofu consumption has hit double digit in 2018. Wow. So we're super excited to hear that.
And I think another thing that you are doing differently from other tofu companies is creating tofu for Western, traditionally Western cuisine applications. How does that work? How do you convince a chef at Danielle, a classic French restaurant, to use tofu on their menu?
No, that's a great question. Yeah. So because tofu is perceived as this Asian, tofu has an Asian heritage and is perceived as an Asian food. And you know, I didn't want it just to be an Asian food. It didn't have to be an Asian food. So when I started tinkering and coming up with recipes, I like to come up with recipes that I like to eat. And a lot of them are not necessarily Asian recipes. And when we work with chefs through the farmers markets, these relationships blossom into a lot of R&D in the chef's kitchen. So while the chef is learning from us, the textures, the flavors, how to work with tofu and yuba, we're learning from them about flavors, about trends. And through this process is where we come up with a whole line of products that are not Asian recipes at all. Like, you know, one of our best sellers are Moroccan tofu cubes. And we have a harissa tofu cube. We have barbecue. And none of these are Asian flavors, but they're doing really well in the marketplace.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's some, I think it just tastes great. These products, everything we make, you know, it's important that they taste great. So we test it. We have the luxury at the farmers markets, small market groups. We have relationship with retailers that are willing to test smaller markets. So it allows us to iterate. We have chefs that work with us to help refine these recipes. So when something tastes great, I don't think people care whether it's tofu or whether it's high protein plant-based or meat or whatever. You know, I think the first thing you have to do is conquer the taste piece. And we've successfully done that with a lot of our recipes. And then everything else is kind of like icing on the cake. You know, you eat it and you're like, damn, this tastes good. And you're like, wait. And you look at the ingredients and you're like, whoa, there are only 10 ingredients and I understand everything here. And it's organic and it's good for me. So, you know, everything downstream, it's really icing on the cake. You know, everything we put out there has to taste great.
The food scene today is pretty different from the food scene, at least the food entrepreneurship scene was 15 years ago, maybe across the board, the dishes that restaurants are serving, what you can get at the supermarket. And I think you're different from a lot of the guests who we have on. Most people have started their business in the last, you know, 5 or so years. You've been around a fair amount longer than that.
I'm an old man.
I wouldn't go that far, but your business is definitely more established than a lot of the entrepreneurs who join us on the podcast. So what was the climate like when you were starting your business? What did that allow you to do? And what do you see happening today for food entrepreneurs?
Yeah, you're right. I think, you know, starting a food business 15 years ago, it's very different from starting a food business even 5 years ago. You know, my cohort at the time in the Bay Area were really amazing long-term entrepreneurs. You know, we're looking at Steve Sullivan of Acme Bread. You know, we're looking at Calgar Creamery. We're looking at Blue Bottle. Most of these businesses are still around today. Many of them started out at the farmers markets, and it was through the farmers markets movement, the organic movement, the eat local movement that we were able to thrive. And also at the time, it wasn't as easy to raise capital like it is today. I think in the last decade between all the TV shows about food, between the interest in the food space and the climate, the environmental impact of food, we are having more and more conversations about food. The interest level by the consumers are much higher today than they were a decade ago. And we are also seeing a lot of money coming into food investments following the tech approach. And, you know, in the Bay Area, there's a lot of tech money going into food, especially, you know, more recently, in the last 5 years, there is now a whole category called food tech, you know, and there's a lot of that is related to the environment. So there are a lot more money coming into food. And I think because of that, I think entrepreneurs are having to move a lot faster. Especially if they take investments. And it's harder to be patient, whether you have a choice or not.
Do you think if you were starting your business today instead of 15 years ago, how would you be doing things differently? Or?
Wow. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure, actually. I think my DNA has always been to take sort of two steps and then figure out the next five steps. So we're very good at pivoting. We're pretty opportunistic. So I'm not sure I would just follow the tech model of just taking a lot of money and acquiring a lot of customers and not looking at the bottom line.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think I would do a lot differently today than I did 10, 15 years ago.
So take us back. So you're in year one. You're deciding that you're going to start making tofu. You're selling it at farmers markets. Talk to us about the first few years and kind of how you transitioned through that. And especially what I'm curious to hear is, as somebody who came from outside of the food industry, what were the most challenging kind of gaps that you had to kind of cross?
Right. I think I was really learning, because my mindset is the first couple of years were really testing grounds. The farmers markets were testing grounds for me to prove a concept. And the concept was, A, you know, can I make a better tofu, a better food, a tastier food? And there are a lot of models there. Like I mentioned before, better bread, better cheeses, better chocolate. And the farmers markets were great places to do those experiments. You know, so I was constantly testing recipes, price points, and getting feedback. It's the best feedback loop, and pivoting to give the customers what they want, what they need. And we were very lucky to grow from one farmer's market to, at the peak of our business, we were doing 12 farmer's markets a week. And that was enough to sustain the business and to pay people a meaningful wage. And so when you're in that mode, or at least when I was in that mode, I wasn't really thinking about gaps. I'm sure there were a lot of things I wasn't looking at, but it required a certain amount of focus on just making sure a few simple things are consistent. Like, let's make sure that it tastes great. You know, let's make sure that the food is safe for people to eat. This was also a time where the regulations on food were not as strict as they are today from a food safety standpoint. But we all know that one false step and the food business will go under. So we've been exceptionally vigilant in terms of quality and safety and whatnot. So I don't know whether I saw any other gaps at the time. So sorry, I couldn't answer that question.
What were some of the mistakes that you made, or some of the things that you got wrong? Maybe a particular flavor or style of preparing tofu, or something that customers didn't respond to that you thought they would?
We were perfect. No, it wasn't so much about recipes, because, you know, I don't really believe in right or wrong. I just believe in, like, you try something and it didn't work and you try something else. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of areas where we learned a lot from was much, had a lot to do with timing of building our business. Like, for example, we launched our plant in 2008. We built this manufacturing plant, and it was during a recession. And that was very challenging because we weren't growing as much as we thought we wanted to. We had all this investment in capital expenditure to build the plant. And it was a very scary time for any entrepreneur. So it's times like that that you really have to figure out, okay, how else can I pivot the business?
So what did you do?
Well, fortunately, we're a pretty open company. We brought people together and we said, hey, you know, we might have to lay off folks. But then at the time I had 6 employees and they decided they wanted to work 60% time so that nobody got laid off. And it was a great lesson for me in terms of camaraderie and community. And we still carry that lesson forward today in terms of how we treat people at Hodo.
Yeah, so how have you extended that value system or that philosophy to the way that you run the business now?
Yeah, it's not easy. We've gone from 6 employees to more than 160 wow. today. You know, our plant has grown, you know, 3 times since then. I think what we've learned from the early days is try to communicate with people as much as you can in terms of directions of the company. Try to provide as much information as possible. We send people to classes. We make sure that they learn English, they communicate well. I still teach a class for our employees once every 2 weeks, talking about any topics that they want as far as the challenges of working there, how to be fair, how to sort of, you know, give verbal warnings, how to ask for help. So a lot of training. We do a lot of training about the workplace and about culture at Hodo.
Why is that a philosophy that you've built into the business?
Well, I think at a personal level, I believe that as an immigrant, I believe in meritocracy. I believe that everyone deserves a chance. I certainly have benefited from that. And a lot of our employees are immigrants. And, you know, we want to make sure that they are at an environment where they can take care of their families, whether they need to pick up their kids early. So we have to work around their schedule, make sure that they're not just doing a job to make money, but they're doing a job where they learn some skills, technical skills, people management skills, so that they can go somewhere else or grow with us. And in the Bay Area, it's super challenging to hire and keep people. And it's our way of maintaining to make sure that we don't have a lot of turnover.
And it works.
And it works, yeah. We have very low turnover, and we have an exceptional benefits program for our employees.
That's great. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dana Cowan, and I'm the host of Speaking Broadly here on HRN. Every week, I conduct intimate interviews with the brilliant, powerful women in the food world. We discuss their lives, their careers, and the ways in which they navigate the world at large. You can find Speaking Broadly wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back with, we're here with Min Tsai, who is the CEO and founder of Hodo Foods, an amazing tofu company based in Oakland, California. And we're also joined by my Burlap and Barrel co-founder, Ori Zohar, who is our guest co-host this week while Jenny is off having more fun adventures in Morocco than she would be having if she were stuck in this in our studio in Brooklyn.
Hello, hello.
So one thing that comes up for me and for Ori in our business a lot, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, is the balance between idea and operation, between vision and implementation, between often those things come from different people. I think this is common in a lot of businesses, a lot of whether it's a co-founder relationship or a colleague relationship, where I'll have some crazy idea and just to use our business as an example, I'll have some crazy idea, I'll figure out how to make it happen, and it's going to be extremely imperfect and, you know, scraped together with duct tape and force of will, and it happens the first time, and then Ori, being the systems thinker, comes in and goes, okay, we're not going to do it.
I get very stressed out. I come back.
We're not going to do it that way again. Right. And you come back and go ahead.
Yeah. And then try to figure out how do we take this one off? And if there's a good reaction from it, we test it out. We see if people come back and say, hey, we like that. Then we figure out how do we turn this into something we can repeat, that we can do more of, and that we can do efficiently.
You guys are perfect for each other.
I guess. Well, tell us about that process for you. You seem like you're more systems oriented. You seem like you enjoy the operational aspect of running your business. How do you combine that with ideas? How do you make sure the ideas are still flowing, even right, when you get buried in the minutia of, you know, building a new plant and running a significant team?
Right. The thing about ideas is that there are no stupid ideas, right? You have to honor ideas. So I'm a big believer in ideas. So it's very hard for me when I hear an idea, especially if it's an idea that I've heard before, and I can sort of, it's kind of like the Matrix for me in my head. I'm like, and it's all like, I can see the path, and I was like, but I never tell an entrepreneur, like, I don't know about that idea. It's really asking them to answer certain questions that lead them to think through the idea is what I'm all about. I think there are so many ideas out there. And we live with ideas. We survive because we have ideas. But I think the way I like to think about it is much more operational focus. So what I would say to entrepreneurs is continue to come up with the ideas, but either make sure that you have a partner that really can help you sort of plan it out a little bit more. I'm a big believer in the 80-20 rule. I mentioned earlier that, you know, I take two steps and I pivot. Like, you know, we believe in iteration. So take that idea. I think what you guys are doing, it's really solid. You know, something worked, figure out what is it that made it work, and then duplicate and repeat, and then get it bigger and bigger and bigger. So I think finding the right partnership, it's a big part. And I'm very lucky because I have a great partner, my business partner, John Notes, who's also our CFO. So he and I are constantly bantering ideas back and forth. You know, not necessarily product development, but a lot of ideas in terms of the direction of the business, investments, you know, how to move forwards in terms of the marketplace and such.
Well, can you tell us a little bit more about how you met your business founder and how that came to be?
Oh, right. It was serendipity. So I was working at the farmer's markets. This is, I think, 3 years into the business. And John saw the first article that was written about Hodo in a now no longer newspaper called the Bay Area Guardian. And he called me up and he said, hey, you know, I like what you're doing. I think you're onto something. How can I get involved? And I said to John, and I said, oh, wow, you know, you have an MBA and you went to great school and you worked in China and you speak Chinese and all this amazing set of skills, but I can't afford to pay you. So, you know, come work at the farmer's market and figure this out and help me grow the business. And he decided to do that. And so we've been really good partners for a decade. You know, John and I worked together to raise the capitals we need to build the plant. And, you know, we've been working together ever since.
Go ahead, Ethan.
What's your balance of roles or responsibilities, skills? What do you bring to the table? What does he bring to the table?
Sure. I think John is our CFO, so he oversees all of our finances. And that's a luxury for me. You know, like if you learn from sort of everyone would tell you as a CEO, you have to look at the numbers every day. And it's true to a lot in a lot of ways. But for me, like I trust John, so I don't have to do that. Similarly, John trusts me that I'm running a great operations, you know, in terms of people safety, food safety, putting out delicious products, hiring great people to help manage the business. So we have that trust through experience. And as long as we're on the same page in terms of directionally where the business is going, the rest, we give each other the independence and trust that we will come to each other when we need to bounce an idea.
I think something that's challenging for a lot of, especially early stage food entrepreneurs, and especially entrepreneurs who are in the position that you were in, where you'd been running the business for a few years before your business partner came on, is that feeling of letting go, of ceding control, of putting your vision in someone else's hands, and then navigating the conflict that can arise from that stress. How do you and John deal with it? What advice do you have for entrepreneurs who are looking at those situations themselves?
No, I think that's an important point. I think, you know, founders in general are sometimes so tied to the title of founder, to the ideas themselves, that they're unable to let that go. Fortunately for me, you know, John and I are very open to each other, and we don't have, we have egos, but not massive egos. Even while we were at the farmers markets, I remember one of the first thing John was concerned about was like, are people coming to buy our tofu at the farmers markets because Min is there? And that was a great question. So we have to test that theory out. We have to set up farmers markets where I'm not the one selling to see if there's any dip in sales. So we have to prove that people are eating our products because it's delicious and not because, you know, some guy out there is convincing them how to do it and how to eat it. So these are that's just one example of how we work together. And I think that's something that every entrepreneur or founder needs to figure out on his or her own. It's to work through the ego and letting go.
Yeah, that's great advice. And so to pick up now, so you're in farmers markets, you have a co-founder, you have a factory at this point, your first initial factory. Where it take us, where do we go from here? Where does the story lead?
I think the story naturally led us through the various trends, the food trends in America. So while the basic ingredient is tofu, somewhat considered back then as very much an Asian food, the trend that the various trends that we sort of crossed really thrust us into this amazing space of plant-based food. And let me sort of explain. So the first few years were really related to organic food. So everything we make is organic. We don't do sort of half this, half that. So all organic ingredients. There was a tremendous interest in that when we first started out. Then the farmers markets. You know, people want to eat closer and understand the foods better and support local businesses. Then restaurants. Because we were at the farmers markets, we were able to collaborate with chefs in the Bay Area. And therefore, it allows the chefs to really understand the ingredients. And when they understood the ingredients and they felt very proud of the ingredients, it allowed us to really get on their menu. So, you know, we remain the only tofu company that is on all the menus of restaurants that we work with. And it is because of such sort of brand loyalty and delicious food and education that we ended up working with Chipotle. And we are the Sofritas tofu for, you know, thousands of Chipotle nationally. And that in itself was a culinary relationship. You know, the whole idea of really high protein, delicious, low process food. So that really blossomed into not only a national business, but also the first non-Asian mass market tofu. And so from there, you know, we sort of have to build the second plant or expand our plant to basically supply Chipotle's and other chains. You know, we supply the entire Silicon Valley, all the commissaries from Google to Facebook to Apple. You know, they use our nuggets and our firm tofu and our braised tofu. So it allowed us to really grow primarily in the food service side, branded food service side. And then we started growing on the retail side much more recently in the last 5 years. You know, selling locally, to the Whole Foods and the natural stores. And then the last 3 years is when we focus on growing into the mass market. And what that meant is that we have to communicate to the public that the base ingredient is tofu, but ultimately it's just a really delicious food that now fits into the category that everyone wants to move towards, which is plant-based diet. We're a little bit ahead of it because we're in the Bay Area. You know, we have folks like Michael Pollan. We have folks that talk about eating closer to the ground. And soybeans, we've educated people. It comes from the legumes families. So if you're out there drinking peas milk, you know, stuff made with peas protein, it's the same family. So I think all the information that people are seeking about soy and protein, it's on the public, the research is all there, and the adoption rate is really moving super fast. We've shown people that this food, it's been around for thousands of years, it's healthy for you, and you know, the interest, the information has really allowed us to, in the last 2 years, grew from like 500 grocery store to 4,000 grocery store. So that's really a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of work. And particularly starting in branded retail, which is branded food service, rather, which is a particularly hard place to start to try to convince a chef to share their credit, right? Like chefs are not known for wanting to share credit. How did you make that happen? You maybe are still the only really branded tofu on the market across the board, food service, retail.
Right. Yeah.
So how did you extend that brand that you had built and I guess continues to evolve? How did you extend that to restaurants? How did you get chefs to want to share that credit?
Yeah, I think it's really related to education, collaboration, and being open. You know, when we opened our tofu plant, we basically opened it up for chefs to come and tour. So the onus was on us to really educate the chefs and the culinary programs about this amazing and versatile ingredients. Like literally you can go from liquid to solid and every stage of texture. You know, I can take a chef to our Yuba table and they'll see soy milk and then the various textures of Yuba. I mean, burrata cheese texture, you know, al dente pasta texture.
What's Yuba?
Yuba is the cream of soy milk. I've been doing it for so long. I think everyone should know about Yuba.
They should. If they don't, they should.
That's right.
And now they will.
Now they will. Thank you. It's a cream of soy milk. It's a sheet that forms. It's very similar to the cream of your whole milk. Like sometimes if you buy whole milk, you see a layer of cream on top. Soy milk, because of the thick soy milk we make, there's a layer on top that's called Yuba. It's a Japanese term for the cream of soy milk.
And how is it used? What does it taste like? What's the texture?
It depends on when you harvest it. Now I'm going to get geeky on
you
guys.
Let's go. I love
it. But basically, if you have milk and you leave it for a while, there's going to be a skin or the cream that rises to the top. And the first texture in Japanese, it's called kumiage, and it means scoop. It means that the cream is so delicate that the only way you can harvest it is you have to use something to scoop it up. Because if you try to pick it up with your fingers, it's going to fall apart. And so it's a delicacy. You know, restaurants like Daniel's and everywhere uses it as a cream. It's a vegan cream. It's delicious mixed with uni or oysters. And then there are different layers that you can harvest at different time. And each one has a very unique texture. And when you eat it, it's got this amazing creamy, sweet, fatty mouthfeel that is so novel for chefs that it's hard for them to eat it for the first time. They're making it there and they're like, oh, I gotta have it, you know, like, and we teach them how to make it. So I think that knowledge is one of the reasons we're like, wow, this is so amazing. I gotta call them out on the menu. I gotta thank Min for showing me all this stuff. It's how we ended up working. You know, Chipotle had a dozen chefs coming through working with us. And we have these amazing events that you can see on our website called Tofu Disrupt, where it's annual collaborations with chefs, you know, in New York, in San Francisco, to really take them through the process of tofu and yuba making and educate them about the science and the art, and then allowing them to use their own creativity to really help us come up with amazing recipes. So that collaboration, it's really the reason I think we're on all the menus of whether it's a fast casual chain like Chipotle or a Daniel in New York or a Single Thread that's in, you know, Napa. So
really interesting to hear also about your thoughts on managing kind of the cash flow of a food business. Everybody, I think a lot of people, as they're starting their company, they know where do I get the money to build a factory? Where do I get the money to build inventory? How do I approach this? I know early on you did a little bit of fundraising, but from then on you've been self-financing. So would love to just hear a little bit about how you've thought about that and how you've handled kind of the capital component of the business.
I wish John was here so he can answer that question. It's kind of like that game show. Can I make a call to a friend?
Yeah,
exactly. I think it's very challenging. You know, the reason we've been around for 15 years is because we didn't want to grow at sort of warp speed. We didn't want to grow like a tech company. I think in our space, and this is really interesting because this I realized much recently, if you look at plant-based food, it's a relatively new category. If you look at all the sort of brands in the marketplace today, most of them are making their own products. There are no co-packers in that space yet, with the exception of, say, almond milk, maybe. You know, if you look at the vegan cheese category, the non-dairy cheese category, everyone is making their own cheeses. So it's very difficult for a business like us to find a co-packer. So for us to grow, we can only grow if we build more capacity. And to build more capacity, we basically have to make enough money to grow a little bit at a time. And it's lower risk from that standpoint as well. You're not risking capital from investors. And also, it's not tech. Our category is growing really fast, but it's not really dominated by someone who's growing like 1,000% year over year, like a software. So, you know, healthy growth in food and retail food is, you know, double digit. And for us, we've been growing in the last 5 years more than 30% year over year. And to us, that's really like stretching and very healthy growth. Beyond that, you know, I would hate my lifestyle. And the rest of our team would probably hate their lifestyles.
In the last few minutes of the interview, we transitioned to a lighter, more fun, kind of funny personal question segment. So we're going to throw some funny personal questions at you. And are you ready?
Sure. I think.
Which one of your many tofu-based products do you most closely identify with? Which one do you feel like is the best representation of you and your personality?
Wow. Definitely Yuba, because it's versatile and it's somewhat unique, singular, kind of like me. Mm-hmm. No, I'm kidding. But versatility.
Okay.
So, yeah, Yuba.
Because what are some of the things that you can do with Yuba?
Oh, pretty much anything. I can turn Yuba into a cheese. I can turn it into a pasta. I can make it into a texture. I can fry it into a chip. You know, that's how amazing Yuba is. And it's got 21 grams of protein per serving. It's as much protein as beef.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing, amazing cream.
What's your favorite unexpected dish to make with tofu? When you tell people I make X with my tofu, they're blown away.
I think I'm constantly surprised by how simple, how people love simple recipes with our tofu. Like, I would take our braised tofu, slice it up, stir fry with some scallion, and people are oohing and eyeing over it because they're like, it's smoky, it's got this five spice flavor. What an amazing texture. And I think it's a great reminder because I've been at it for 15 years. I don't have the same deep appreciation as I did when I first started out.
One of the things that I've been waiting to pick up is sweet applications for tofu. I mean, there are Chinese and I think across Asia puddings, tofu-based puddings with sugar syrups or other sweeteners that are really exceptional. I mean, like panna cotta, but better. I mean,
good point.
Why has that not happened? Why is tofu so specifically associated with savory flavors?
Well, I'll give you the short answer because the long answer requires too much scientific explanation.
Yeah.
There's a great confectionery chef called Michael Ricciuti in San Francisco. He's basically tinkered with our tofu more than once. The challenge of tofu, it's not because it couldn't make really delicious confectionery or sweet. It's the fact that tofu pushes water out and it leaches water. So it makes a lot of products wet. So the silken tofu with the ginger syrup you talked about is one of my favorite. The challenge with that is it doesn't have the shelf life. Mm. So I can make it at a restaurant. And in fact, many of our restaurants make that. You know, you go to State Bird and they have a silken tofu made with our soy milk with all kinds of savory or sweet topping. So we teach chefs how to do that. But unfortunately, not yet ready for retail prime time.
And, I was at Saper two nights ago.
Yeah. There you go.
And had some tofu. If you were going to, if you could master a skill overnight, any skill, what would it be?
You mean like superhero, like learning how to fly kind of thing?
I mean, it could be that. Or I meant like actual
Ethan's like, practical
skills, like a skill. But we could talk about your superpower too. What would your superpower be?
You know, I think maybe hang gliding.
Hang gliding?
Yeah. Because I like to look at stuff from above.
Okay.
So that's why the whole superhero learning how to fly thing.
If you were a superhero, your power would be...
I want to be like able to fly, yeah.
Where would you fly to? What would you use it for?
Just flying around, checking things out, looking at the world from a little bit higher up.
Just for fun?
Just for fun, yeah.
We ask people this question, you know, periodically, and transportation superpower comes up. It's probably the single most common.
Right.
I want to be able to teleport. I want to be able to fly. It often winds up being a very practical consideration. Somebody will say, I'm always late, so I want to be able to teleport. Or I don't want to have to sit on an airplane, so I want to be able to fly. But I appreciate that your answer is not practical at all.
No.
It would just be fun to fly around.
Just be fun to fly around, yes.
It could be a factor of the congested cities that most of the people on the show come from.
Yeah, we are in Brooklyn.
Subconscious, yeah. Yes.
Maybe. Ori, what would your, if you could master a skill overnight, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to say something like spreadsheets, but...
No, next, pick another answer.
I think I would love, and this is a skill that I'm actually working on, but I've been living in tiny, tiny apartments.
Awesome.
Like my entire post-college life, and in college also. I really want to get into gardening and growing, and one of my dreams has always been to have a fruit tree, like something that bears fruit. I had that as a kid growing up, and for some reason, a 600-square-foot apartment in San Francisco is not conducive to growing fruit trees, but I'm going to figure it out, and so I think it's something that's 2019 or 2020 goal.
That's a good one.
You're growing a cardamom plant.
Yes, as anybody who follows me on Instagram may know, I am carefully cultivating a cardamom plant on my windowsill in Queens. Not a whole lot of space. But
so get ready for the first burlap and barrel. Carefully, harvest.
Carefully, what did you say? Carefully
cultivating
a cardamom in Queen.
Yeah.
That is pretty neat.
And he told me that he pours coffee on the cardamom because the cardamom seems to like it.
Yeah, I read that cardamom likes acidic soil, and so I've been looking for acids in my kitchen and not acid in my... Anyway.
Soybeans does not like acidic soil.
Oh, no?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I grow
they cannot grow
a soybean
together.
Field, I won't intercrop it with cardamom.
Nope.
What does a soybean field look like, since we're on the topic?
Soybean grow, it's a nitrogen-fixing legume, so it grows great with corn. That's why all of our soybeans are grown in the Midwest of the U.S.
And what do the plants look like? How do they grow?
They look like edamame.
I mean,
which
they
is kind of
edamame.
A vine. Yeah, they are edamame. Good point. Yeah, most people don't know that edamame is young soybeans.
Yeah.
I will have people saying, I'm allergic to soy, but then eat edamame. I'm like, okay.
Sure.
It's the same thing, right?
What did you eat for lunch as a kid growing up? What were your favorite lunches?
Street food. In Vietnam, it's like anywhere you go, you can get a crepe, you can get sticky rice, you can get a skewer of something. You can pick fruit off trees in the neighbor's yard. So I was pretty much a street urchin in Vietnam. So mostly street food.
Are the neighbors happy about you picking the fruit, or are they chasing you down with a stick?
Most of the times they tell me to go away.
stop stealing our,
that's
our
right.
oranges or
exactly.
whatever. You're
exactly.
Do you have Vietnamese restaurants in New York or in San Francisco that you really love?
You know, I don't know the Vietnamese restaurants in New York. In fact, I was texting a friend of mine to see whether he has any suggestion. He said, no, my boyfriend who's Vietnamese cooks everything. I'm like, thanks a lot. So there is one restaurant in Queens, and I'm blanking on the name. It's a chef from Slanted Door that moved over there.
Oh, yeah.
Bricolage.
Yeah.
And it's delicious.
In Brooklyn, I think.
In Brooklyn, yeah. Last time I was there.
Yeah.
Lynn made I'm so happy for her. She was a protege of Charles Van from Slanted Door, and she came out here and killed it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there does seem to be this sort of moment for Vietnamese food in New York City, which has not historically had a great Vietnamese food scene. But There are a half dozen restaurants, Hanoi House.
Maybe you can give me some recommendations.
In the East Village and another one that just opened last week, the name of which escapes me at the moment. But and getting into some of the regional differences throughout Vietnam, which I think are...
Yeah, totally. I think I recently ate at in Oakland at a restaurant that won James Beard called Nayum. Mm. And it's a Cambodian restaurant in deep in Oakland. And what's amazing about it is as I was eating the flavors, I can see how much it is related to Vietnamese food. And I agree with you. I think now is the time to start, well, not just Vietnamese regional cuisine, but any regional cuisine specific to a region, I think has tremendous opportunity for success.
Yeah. Any other advice, parting words? What message would you send to an early stage or aspiring food entrepreneur?
Eat well, make the food delicious. So here are my golden rules. One, make it absolutely delicious. And I don't mean delicious just because you love it. Get your friends to taste it. Get your neighbors, as broad a population, to agree with you, to agree that it's delicious. So that's first and foremost. The second thing after you make it delicious is make it cheap. And I know it's not easy, right? So make it delicious, make it cheap. So if you can do those two things, then you'll be able to get into the retail market.
All right. And thank you so much for joining us. Where can our listeners find out more about you and where can they find Hodo?
So I'm all over the internet. If you go to YouTube or Google Hodo Foods videos, there's like a ton of videos about how we make stuff. You know, my whole history is out in public. But more importantly, if you're in the you know, Triborough area, go to Whole Foods, Fresh Direct, Chipotle, Fairway, we're everywhere, Target, and try our tofu. You won't regret it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And you can find me via our spice company, Burlap and Barrel. We're at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, burlapandbarrel.com. As always, you can reach us, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. If you have nominations, feedback, questions for upcoming guests, always feel free to get in touch. And we're at YFood Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks to Jeet, our awesome engineer, for keeping us alive this hour, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without the support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.